This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Annie Lux, Margot Avery, and Lee Costello. Annie is playwright of the play The Portable Dorothy Parker, and Margot is the actress who plays Dorothy Parker, Lee Costello, director. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So this is a one-woman show about the fabulous Dorothy Parker. What was your inspiration, Annie, for creating this play?
It was actually Lee's inspiration for creating the play. Lee and I had worked together many years earlier, and she had directed an early play of mine. And
I had known Margot as an actress for many, many years as well. And Annie and I lost touch with each other over the years, ran into each other again at Margot's apartment, total happenstance. And I had always thought that Margot should play Dorothy Parker. She just had a sensibility about language and a wit that matched. And I knew Annie's writing, but also my experience of Annie was that she also had the same sensibility as Dorothy Parker, just sort of that lovely sense of turning a phrase. And I thought the two should work together on it, and I thought she was the writer to do it. So,
and my mother agreed.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, Annie was there reading to my mother, who had gone blind from macular degeneration.
Oh, heavens.
And my mother actually knew Dorothy Parker very slightly back in 1940. And knew her writing, of course, grew up with her writing. So when Lee said, I've always thought Margot should play Dorothy Parker, my mother chimed in with, oh, yes, I've always thought so, too.
Really? And you probably didn't even know that.
No, I didn't really.
So tell us a little bit about Dorothy Parker. She was tremendously influential in her time. Probably some of our younger listeners don't know who she is.
I know. Yes, we have found that, and it's very sad. But
but she is the best known, except for maybe George S. Kaufman, of the members of the Round Table, her group, her literary group, in the 20s. She's up there, as you know. Some of the others have fallen by the wayside somewhat.
And we're
more
hoping to get Dorothy Parker more fans every day with our play. And there's a Dorothy Parker Society.
There's several different pages on Facebook dedicated to Dorothy Parker. Ours is the smallest.
Who was she?
Dorothy Parker was a writer, a critic, and a poet and journalist. She was born in the 1890s, and by the late teens, she was writing theater reviews for Vanity Fair. She was the first woman ever to be a theater critic. She held her own in a group of men in a time when women were not, you know, women had fewer rights and people were much less willing to concede that we were all equal. She was an extraordinary force to be reckoned with in her time. She her books of poetry were New York Times bestsellers. You know, poetry.
And she did a lot of rhyming verse, much of it funny and clever and highly accessible.
That's true. Yeah, it's the And she made fun of herself and of love and of men a lot in her poetry.
And this is the thing about Dorothy Parker, which is so fascinating to me and I'm sure to you and so many others, is that she was so funny and so dry and so witty and acerbic and really kind of a tough character, and yet so vulnerable at the same time and so romantic at the same time. Which some people say are contradictions, but it seems like it's just part of the same character.
She had an extremely soft heart. Injustice always drove her mad. Her father ran basically a sweatshop, and that's what they lived on, and she was horrified by it at a very early age. And she kept on having being very involved in social causes. She founded the Screenwriters Guild along with Dashiell Hammett and Lillian Hellman and Donald Ogden Stewart in the 40s, back when, you know, union was a four-letter word to a lot of people. Although I guess it's still
30s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she got blacklisted.
She did.
Yes, she did.
cutting short what could have been a very promising Hollywood career. Well, I mean, it was a Hollywood career. She got some Academy Award nominations.
Yes, she did.
They were pretty done by then.
Don use it. Didn't Hitchcock use her anyway for a lot of his films in the 50s and 60s?
Yeah, I think he did. Mm.
So she...
She was sought after for dialogue punch-up especially.
Right. Mm. So, Annie, how did you put yourself into Dorothy Parker's mind to write this play? I mean, is a lot of it her words? It sounds so much like her.
Well, I moved to Santa Fe right after we decided to do this. And I sat at Downtown Subscription and read everything that she'd ever written, and I've got a stack of note cards about yay high, and started putting things together. And at a certain point, it felt like I was channeling Dorothy Parker, or like, you know, she was living in my head anyway. And it was quite the experience, I have to say.
Then you came to New York and did the same thing for a month.
Right, for a month. Every single day I went to a cafe across the street from Margot's apartment in Greenwich Village, and just, like, it was my office, and wrote and wrote and wrote, and Dorothy and I wrote together, and Lee came a little bit later and said, okay, now you have to do this, you have to write a joke to match that joke, and I'm like, okay. Now, so I'm, like, writing Dorothy Parker-like lines.
Well, this is a thing. I mean, I wondered, like, there was a line that stood out to me, like, she was talking about a man she'd been involved with, and she said, that's what I get for putting all my eggs in one bastard. Did she write that, or did
she? She wrote that one.
Okay.
There are some lines that we can't remember if they're hers or mine.
Oh, my goodness.
And we have to go look it up.
Yes, it's quite seamless.
And there's one fabulous one that we know Annie wrote.
Yes.
We're not going to tell you which one.
All right. This means that, ladies and gentlemen, you must all come to this play, which, by the way, is happening at the Lodge Cabaret Room this coming weekend, the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, November 6th, 7th, and 8th, and we'll give you all the details at the end of this program. I guess when you read this, I mean, here she is, a fabulous woman writer and really a pioneer for so many women.
Yes.
She just wanted to be a writer, wrote a poem that was accepted, talked herself into a job at the magazine that accepted it, and just went forward. I don't know if it was fearlessly or just, you know, fearfully, but just did it anyway.
She was quite driven. She wanted a literary life, and she made one for herself. She also wanted a romantic life, and she had rather a harder time making that for herself. But
yeah, well, especially, I mean, she seemed to have all kinds of romance, but none of them what one might call happy or successful.
Right. Until Alan. The early years with Alan Campbell were very happy.
Yeah, they had 10 years of a really good marriage, I think. There.
And then they divorced and remarried?
Yeah. Yes, but it didn't go very well the second time.
You get the feeling that it's sort of more fun to read her than it would have been to be her.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, she was riddled with self-doubt. I mean, it's almost a cliche that, you know, that great artists think they're crap. But she was always afraid that she was, and she never felt that she'd arrived or really written up to her potential. There's a story that's not in the play about she tried to write a novel, and she was in Europe for a year writing this novel, and at a certain point she just destroyed everything she'd written. It's so sad.
Yeah, which is the story of a lot of first novels. And many authors who've written successful novels say that their first one absolutely belongs in the incinerator.
But she never wrote another one.
Yeah.
That was it.
She was also traveling in circles with Hemingway and people of that nature. So
yes, she had and Sherald.
Yeah. She adored Hemingway's writing. She just worshipped him.
Yeah, and that's another thing the play brings out, which I find fascinating, is that she really, I mean, she makes fun of everybody. I mean, that, what was the line about Calvin, that she said when Calvin Coolidge died?
How could they tell?
Right. But Hemingway, who apparently looked down on her, she had nothing but respect and worship for, and actually was very vulnerable to the fact that he did look down on her.
Very much
that's
so.
That's true. There were writers that she didn't like personally, like Dashiell Hammett, that she still praised highly in it, you know, when she reviewed their work.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, she adored Ernest
Hemingway.
Yeah,
she just adored everything about Ernest Hemingway.
He didn't deserve it.
So hard to believe. She, one of the things about her that I, that my little feminist heart disapproves of is that she used to pray, apparently, please God, don't let me write like a woman. And that's so sad to me.
Why?
Well, because she was a successful woman writer at a time when women were just emerging, you know, as writers and as equals to men. And to feel that there was something inferior about women's writing is, and you're a woman writer, is really sad. It's almost sadder than, you know, that just the regular artist thing of thinking, oh, well, I'm crap, because that's whatever. But specifically because I'm female. You know?
I don't know. I mean, it's funny. When you say that, what I hear is the kind of trivial women's writing of her time.
Maybe that was it. And that would be much more understandable. But, you know, Jane Austen is a woman writer. Charlotte Bronte was a woman writer. And she loved, I believe she loved Middlemarch, which was written by George Eliot, who was a woman writer.
At the same time, a lot of the literary world looked down on all of those writings because they were trivial. They were about relationships. They were about people.
Oh, and relationships are so trivial.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, relationships are all there is on this earth. Whether it be biological little cells crawling around in the earth or
so
us.
True. So true.
We're talking about the Portable Dorothy Parker, a one-woman show that opens this weekend. And let's talk about the setup for the play. It takes place, what, at the kind of end of World War II about?
No, the beginning.
1943.
Okay.
In the middle.
And she is, by this time, Dorothy Parker, very successful. Viking is publishing an edition of her work called The Portable Dorothy Parker, and the play involves kind of the editing process.
Yes, the choosing. She's choosing the works that are going to go into The Portable Dorothy Parker.
Annie pointed out something to me that I didn't know the other day. Dorothy Parker was the first author who was living that Viking did a portable edition of. First living author. All of their others were deceased.
I think Shakespeare and these things were put together to send to the men overseas.
Well, that's why they had to be portable.
Exactly, so they were portable. Yeah. Alexander Wolcott actually had the idea to put together like volumes of people's work so that the soldiers overseas could have something to read. That they, you know, didn't have to lug big giant volumes around.
Mm. Right, pre-Kindle.
Right, yes. Very pre-Kindle.
Way pre-Kindle.
Now, let's turn to you, Lee. As the director of this play, how have you, like, prepared for that, and what has the process been like?
Well, mostly with one person's show, often the challenge is not so much what the person is saying, but what is the person doing while they're saying this, because this is an awfully long monologue. So keeping it alive and moving is generally the challenge. Annie came up with a brilliant premise, though, the idea that she has to select these works and put them into a book, and yet at the same time, she was a terrific procrastinator. She didn't like to get to work often. So the idea that there's a chore ahead of her, that she has to complete this, drives the play a bit. But also it enables her to tell us about her life. And she's speaking to an offstage character who is a young woman, very much like Dorothy was when she was a young woman. So she's setting the record straight, she's instructing her, and finally she treats her as entre nous. She tells her some things that she probably shouldn't have said had she not been drinking. You know, those sorts of things as she moves along. Also, there's some issues at play in her mind at the time, which her husband has gone off to war. She's just learned this horrible secret from someone she thought was a dear friend who she felt betrayed by. So there are some discoveries that happen in real time while she is trying to do this work. And at the same time, she does like to talk a bit about what really happened, what really occurred at the round table, what really happened behind the scenes.
Right, which is kind of literary gossip that we just like.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And what does she have against Poughkeepsie?
Oh, probably nothing. It just Poughkeepsie's a funny word.
It's got a K in it.
Yeah. And it and
that's
that,
where I'm from.
Oh no!
That's good.
You're from Poughkeepsie? But oh, you poor dear. Well, then you know what we mean.
Vassar College is in Poughkeepsie.
I know. I think, you know, she just pulled that out of a hat, really. And it begins with a P, like palm trees. So Poughkeepsie
exactly.
with palm trees.
Poughkeepsie with
palm
trees.
And it has a K in it, which is always
yes.
funny.
Yeah, she described Hollywood or California as Poughkeepsie with palm trees, just to be clear.
Right, right. All the while, death and suicide seem to be her constant companions. Mm-hmm.
She was raised by her father. Her mother died when she was very small. And then she had a stepmother who died when she was just beginning puberty. And her father used to take them to the cemetery to visit her mother's grave. Everybody, including his second wife. It was a ritual. And apparently he would, you know, sort of howl out grief and talk to the dead. And so the death was very, very... much a part of her childhood. Then her father's brother went down on the Titanic in 1912, and he never recovered. He just went into a decline, and by that time by that time she was the only child left in the house. Everybody else had grown up, and she was the youngest. So that was a big betrayal to her, I think. He was also a very funny man. He used to, when she was away, he used to send her postcards from their dogs and little verses. And apparently all the witty, you know, snapping at each other was something that they did in the family around the dinner table. So she grew up with that quickness, you know, also as a family thing.
So what's it like for you to play Dorothy Parker? I mean, as you said at the beginning, your own mother thought it would be natural for you, and everybody seems to have thought that as well.
There are some ways in which it's very easy, and then there are ways in which it's difficult. I have to go somewhere that's not really, really very comfortable emotionally. But I love her writing, and I really do love her, with all her faults. I think she was an admirable person.
Yes, and she had that self-doubt and that self-awareness, actually, about herself getting a little too sentimental and a little too maudlin. So she would often pull herself back from the brink with a last line of a poem. But in this presentation, we show her a little more vulnerable than she allowed herself to be publicly. So that's always a challenge for an actress, to mine those sort of emotions. She was also quite the drinker, so that loosened her up a bit as well as she told these stories.
Yeah, it really reminds you of that sort of cocktail culture of yesteryear.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, very much so, yes.
That's coming back into fashion.
Is it?
Mm. Cocktails, the old-fashioned cocktails, oh yeah, they're making quite the resurgence.
Oh dear, but probably...
But in more moderation, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's the lack of moderation, it's that sort of Mad Men-style smoking and drinking that it's almost inconceivable today.
I know,
that's true.
Now, this play it's not premiering here, it was performed in New York?
Yes, we've been working on this together, the three of us, for several years now, and we did this past summer. We did the New York International Fringe Festival, and got great reviews and responses. We sold out our run. It was a small theater, but still, there were 200 plays going on. So it was really, you know, we got a wonderful response. People laughed and had a great time.
She's so funny.
It's very funny. She is. Dorothy Parker is very funny.
That's true.
So once again, it's the Portable Dorothy Parker at the Lodge in Santa Fe, which is up on the hill on St. Francis Drive. It's sort of the last thing on your left before you totally head out of town. Friday and Saturday, November 6th and 7th at 7:30 in the evening. Sunday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And
come early.
Come early.
Cash bar.
Come early and have a drink with Dorothy.
Excellent.
Share cocktails.
Yes, it's the cabaret room, so the bar there will be open for an hour before the show, and you can keep your drinks during the show.
Excellent.
Once the show starts, though, they'll close it.
The service will stop.
Right, right. Okay, so The Portable Dorothy Parker by Annie Lux, directed by Lee Costello, performed by Margot Avery. For more information, you can go to holdmyticket.com and look for this event, The Portable Dorothy Parker. Annie, Lee, and Margot, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You can also go just to theportabledorothyparker.com.
That's right.
Theportabledorothyparker.com. Excellent.
That's our basic webpage.
Okay, very cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to Studio X for their technical support and web design.